Hello and welcome to the Advent IM podcast, Risk and Business. Today I'm delighted to be joined by two very special guests, Paul Minter and Karina Curran, and we're going to be talking about all things mental health, support for forces, serving and veterans. And I think it's fair to say that given what we've all been through over the last 3 years, mental health certainly has to be very close to the top of the agenda. So I'm absolutely delighted to have these two very special people with me here today. Paul, good afternoon. Could I bring you in first and you can introduce yourself and tell our listeners a little bit about what your charity does?
Hi, Mike. Yes, thank you. So I was in the armed forces, in the army, the Household Cavalry Regiment for 18 years, where I joined when I was 16 years old, up until November 2020. And I'd done five frontline tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. And towards the end of my time, I suffered pretty, very badly, in fact, with paranoia, which led into anxiety and ending depression. Subsequently, I was medically discharged from the army, even though I really didn't want to be. But during that time of my discharge, I was still very bad. And so I took it upon myself to move away from the armed forces and learn multiple different ways how I could improve my mindset, which at the time was very negative. And I needed it to be more positive. And I learned this through multiple different good daily habits, everything from journaling, gratitude, affirmations, into learning about nutrition, sleep patterns, the importance of it, have a deeper understanding and awareness, and even going into stuff like stoicism, law of attraction, and all these different things that can help make you a more positive person. And I felt really, really good off this within a few weeks. It was incredible how much of an impact it had on me very quickly. I then started helping other friends that where I knew was struggling, and they were telling their friends. And within a 3 month period, I had over 30 people that I was just giving daily tips to and trying to encourage them. And there was lots and lots of positive feedback from it. So moving forward to my discharge date, I decided with some other friends that by this point I'd lost 8 friends that unfortunately took their own lives. And I decided I wanted to do more to help people with this newfound knowledge that I had. And myself and some others, we decided to come up with a charity where we wanted to set up a retreat where anyone in the armed forces and veterans can go to for seven days and just learn these good daily habits, just installing a deeper understanding and awareness of these different ways, small but very effective ways that they can improve their daily life. From that, we got a full non-profit charity as of August 2021, 2 years ago. I decided that we needed to get this charity out there, let people know who we are and get a bit of funding behind us. So we all decided to do big challenges, and I was the first one. And I ended up setting a new world record where I ran 5,000 miles around all the coastlines of England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, Isle of Wight, and Isle of Man, flying the charity flag, meeting thousands of people along the way, giving talks, meeting business people that hopefully want to get involved with the charity, meeting veterans, meeting families of people that have unfortunately taken their lives. And it was very good. It was all over national media, thankfully. I ended up winning the Pride of Britain Award. And since then, we've partnered with Gymshark, and we do lots of work with Gymshark now and armed forces people. And we're not too far from having our retreat hopefully open in a few months' time. So, yeah, that's me, and that's in a nutshell as to our charity and kind of where we are.
Well, you're going to have to do that run all over again now, aren't you? Because they've just opened the new Northeast Coastal Path.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I'll let someone else do that, I think.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And Karina, hi.
Hi, Mike and Paul. It's a pleasure to be here as well. It's so good to start a conversation with such great empowerment as well, with a great story that comes with it. So well done on all the work that you're doing, and that's to come as well, Paul. So myself, I am a survivor of severe childhood trauma and neglect. And sometimes we hear that in the media, we hear, friends or family members say it, but we never really understand, or many people don't understand the undertone and what that actually means in regards to looking at recovery and post-traumatic growth as well, which is something I'll come to in a bit. So I myself, I'm a trauma coach. It's easier to say it as I'm a life coach that specializes in CPTSD and trauma. That's complex post-traumatic stress disorder. and trauma, which can come in different levels. So you may have surgery, there may be an impact trauma, there may be a loss of an individual and so forth. I know Paul mentioned about the effect that came up when the depression started with paranoia and so forth. So I work specifically with individuals in a virtual capacity where I bring in psychotherapy approaches into the life coaching, and I do things like EMDR, deep state hypnosis, REBT, DBT. So we look at the dialect, we look at the rationality that you're having when you the way that you perceive things as well. So in the last 2 years, my business has been up and coming, and that's got to a place where it's stabilized really nicely. And I've got that flow of clients that are coming in that's predominantly from recommendations. Although we do so much, I do so much media work around it, you know, to promote, but it's the type of work where it self-promotes, basically. You know, same like the charity, when people hear of it and the impact it's having, I think looking at impact on the work that you do is so vital in funding coming in or things progressing and moving forward as well. So yeah, my business has been around for 2 years now, and I'm looking to kind of expand it within workplaces, teaming up with charities and so forth. That's kind of like my blueprint of moving forward.
Brilliant, thank you, Karina. Well, as somebody who has been heading up a small business now for 20 years, I still remember the very early days, and I'm fully aware of how hard it is to get these ventures up and running, be it a charity or a commercial venture. So absolutely well done, both of you. And if my maths is right, you must have both been startups during COVID.
Yeah, I think for me, I was very lucky. I escaped during the first lockdown to the Highlands in Scotland. And I was running around the loch 34 miles when I kind of got the epiphany of starting a charity. And I knew I was leaving the armed forces, and I was like, do I go into a 9-to-5 job? Do I just go, you know, I had quite a few different job offers. But for me, the purpose of helping people, being in the position where I once was, and knowing how many people that personal friends that are suffering very badly, whether that be because they've lost purpose in life or they're struggling mentally. And I just, having this tool, I want to do more. And on a selfish note, it helps me massively as well. There's no greater feeling than when someone says to you, you know, you've helped change my life. I'm in a much better place thanks to you. I mean, you know, I'll take that over any materialistic possession any day.
Amazing. And what made you decide to be a startup around that time, Karina?
So I was actually made redundant from a Fortune 500 company where I was in leadership. And that was right at the end, towards the end, where you could just about start seeing people of the pandemic. So I had a choice, because obviously, not obviously, but for myself, I did hit depression massively, but I also had some money that I can invest in something. So for me and the small handful of loved ones around me that were like, go with what you really want to do. And I thought to myself, okay, what have I got that I can give that can also enable me to make a living in a way that feels really good? And there isn't all this red tape that can come in a corporation, you know, when you're within a corporation as an employee. So I studied with a specific company, and it was funny because in lockdown, I'd done the bulk of my training based around life coaching, because I wanted to incorporate it with executive coaching so that my team could be the best team. So I ended up having, because in lockdown I had loads of time, right? So I ended up having a bulk of assets that I ended up gaining off the back of that training that I was able to then inject into myself and use the money and invest in myself, create a business, write a small book, launch a podcast, but also develop myself further so I could offer something that was extremely unique. And what I wanted to do specifically was work directly with memories. That was the main idea that I had. I thought of people in the stories you hear of dream catchers. I kind of wanted to be a memory catcher that helps capture and desensitize traumatic memories. That was kind of like the flow of how I got into it.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So, I mean, there's a kind of irony here, isn't there, that both of you have ended up doing what you're doing today as a result of your previous careers being cut short and not of your own doing. You know, I mean, Paul, yours, you know, medical discharge from the military, Which is interesting, because I think that had it been a fixable physical injury, then the high likelihood you would have been put through a treatment program, had physiotherapy, and returned to your unit.
Yeah, I mean, it was such a hard concept because for me, the military was my life, it was my family. People I grew up as an adult with was from the age of 16 up to what was 36, 35 at the time, something like that. And when they told me that I was no longer suitable for the armed forces, which is everything I'd ever done, it was not only was I in a bad place mentally, I was now being told that I was no good for the one thing that I loved. And it
It's taken away a lifestyle as well as a living, hasn't it?
oh, massively. It's all your friends are there. I was very good at my job. I was in a quite high ranking position where I probably had over 40 soldiers below me that were, that looked up to me, and I enjoyed teaching them and spending time with them and improving them as soldiers as well. So yeah, it's very, very difficult. But and at that moment in time, it's very difficult to see how you're going to move forward, how is life going to get any better now? Everything's taken away from you and I don't feel good. And it's something that I'm a big advocate of the armed forces. I know that it can give you a lot of good stuff in life, but unfortunately, I did see the side where you are just a commodity. You are just a number, and it really hurts. And since the day I left the armed forces, since they discharged me, I've never had a phone call or a letter or anything, just checking up and seeing how you are. So you are completely cut off, and yeah, I can see how people can fall very, very quickly, and I do see that all the time. And it signifies how important it is to have charities and organisations out there to help pick up the pieces for people that are suffering badly once leaving the armed forces.
Yeah. And Karina, you mentioned in your introduction that you yourself had been through childhood trauma. So were you able to access help that enabled you to go on and become a rounded adult? Or is something that you've dealt with yourself? Or and I mean, do you feel that doing what you do now helps you even more to deal with some of the past experiences?
Yeah, that's such a great question, quite rounded as well, because it kind of links into what Paul was saying. So if we don't have the support in the way that we need it, and the thing with trauma is when you have an it, when it's repeated trauma, if it's PTSD or CPTSD, which is more to do with childhood, it means that the trauma went on for a period of time, like repetitive, and you had no choice but to stay in it. So when you're then out of it, if you don't have the support as a child to understand attachment and understand relationship building and understand how to speak with confidence, there's all these little things that you just don't have, but you have no knowledge of not having it, so it doesn't exist in your world. But you kind of feel different from everyone else, but you can't put your finger on it. You just know that was your life until, as you start getting older, you realize there's a term for this. It's called something. A lot of the time in the past, it was just called depression. But then when I look at the scope of what I did go through, I just think that's beyond depression. That's on just on another level. So CPTSD kind of incorporates that kind of what's really going on. Did I get support? No. I was completely let down by the system continuously, as was my younger baby brother, whose life got lost. He was actually murdered by the person that was inflicting all this horrible stuff to me as well. So I was a child that managed, I got to grow up, and I always say that in my work. I don't say I'm lucky, I just say I'm proud of it. Because was it luck? No, it was adults choosing to do the right thing against adults choosing to do the wrong thing. And I had these pinnacle adults that chose to do the right thing and be like role models, like a foster parent, a role model, the person that adopted me, a role model, for example. The support that I got has actually been in the last 2.5 to 3 years, believe it or not. And my life has just completely excelled, but in a very different way, which Paul might be able to speak to there, in regards to when you do get the support that you need, you understand that it's not a quick fix, which a lot of commissioners with charities, they want to see numbers, they want to see results. With trauma, it doesn't quite work like that because there's a constant flow. And if you're re-traumatized in some way because something's missed or you just couldn't express yourself, you fall back into those numbers. So the flow of numbers are constantly going round, but the output is a smaller percentage. But that smaller percentage is so valuable because it's human life. Rather than not seeing value in it, and as you said, eight friends passing away, you know, it's just like taking their life. I know there's a new term which hopefully one of you know what that term is. I can't remember what it is, but it's not committed suicide anymore. And I'm glad that they've changed the wording around that, because I don't believe it's not that individual's fault. To feel like there is no other option, and to feel like coping mechanisms cannot fall into that space, because needs need to be met. that's how we live as humans. To feel like there's nothing that can meet that need, and to go to a point where I may as well not exist. There's no point.
To have that total void in you where life isn't worth carrying on with, you know, and Paul, you know, you've got experience of this, and you know, I know myself, being ex-military, you know, they're not just friends, they're almost a family unit as well.
Yeah, and Karina, like you said, like people don't say or try not to say committed suicide anymore. It's either death by suicide or taking their own life. And I learned that early on. I was on TV and I said committed suicide because I didn't know. That's just the word I knew. And I got about 5 phone calls from family members saying, please don't say that. And looking into it further, in the armed forces, if you take your own life, either as a serving armed forces personnel or a veteran, it is still, they call it committed suicide, and you've actually committed a crime. And because of that, you're not allowed to have your name on any memorial or anything like that. And it's horrendous. But the reason they do it is because of recruitment purposes. They don't want suicide written in all the memorials. But yeah, it's horrendous that happens.
The military have a great track record of looking the other way for anything that isn't mainstream and traditional and fits their particular agenda and PR model, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And it's horrible. I kind of understand it to an extent, as a business extent. But like you were saying, we are so much more than just friends. There's a bond that is, and you don't just get it in the armed forces, you can get it in any community, especially if you've all been through a traumatic part of your life together, which a lot, you know, going to Afghanistan or go to Iraq or wherever you may be, going to a war a torn place and doing the things that you have to do with the person next to you, that bond, no one really kind of understands it, and apart from you and the person that you're next to. And then when that person takes their life, you feel like, oh, especially if it's someone that you look up to or someone that you respect a lot, and you think, well, if they're not strong enough to continue, you know, how am I going to get through this? So it's very difficult to see one of your friends, you know, take their life, because most of the people I knew didn't show any sort of sign. They were happy, they were bubbly, they were just having some serious demons and hard times in their own head, in their own room, in their own space. So it's very difficult to comprehend.
I think it's a very complex, you know, mental health is very complex in some ways, because, you know, whatever is in your mind is reality to you at that point in time. You know, I think it's a Buddhist saying, nothing exists except within the mind. You know, so unlike with most physical issues, you can relate to that and you can step outside of the injury and look at it. But when it's inside your head, it's almost impossible to do that when you're experiencing it.
Yeah, that is so true. And, you know, all the kind of lifestyle changes that Paul mentioned at the beginning, and there was, you know, specific things that you've done, it helps reposition perspective. It helps you understand that actually you do stand in your center and you are enough and you can stand in your integrity and you can say what you need to say to the world. It doesn't have to be tailored in a way because the rest of the world thinks it has to be like that, like the military, for example. I'm not military at all, so just to call that out, but from the stories that I hear and, you know, the different individuals that I've met that are military or ex-military, there's kind of like a, things are done this way, but actually, no, when you are going to war, when you are on tour and so forth, there's so much more that comes into it. What you see, what you hear, you know, what your what you have to do, you know, what the outcome's supposed to be and so forth. There's so much more that comes into it, but also at home you have your family, there's so much dynamics that come into it. And for you to feel like you've been dropped and you don't feel good enough, whereas you know you're good enough. That's what I had that with when I was made redundant, which many people, hundreds of people have it when you're made redundant. It feels like that. The way that happened with you, it's like, should there have been support there? 1,000,000%, of course, because individuals are death by suicide. Why is that happening? And the thing is, we know why. They're just not getting the support in the way that they need it, because they're not being heard in the way that they need it. And hearing someone alone can actually heal them and stop them or pause them from taking a step that can make them no longer be in the world.
And in fact, there's still so much stigma around death by suicide as well, isn't there? You know, it's something that people are almost afraid to come out and talk about as well. You know, I've been very interested in following the Three Fathers and the work that they've been doing following the deaths of their daughters. And I suppose, you know, mental health and mental illness is still very much viewed with a lot of stigma and shied away from being talked about. And I just find it amazing, you know, from you know, shell shock of the First World War through to what we've learnt through Vietnam and, you know, the numerous conflicts the British military have been involved in around trauma and PTSD, that it continues to be something that is so under-supported and under-talked about.
One of the big things that I, when I speak to a lot of people, and I say, do you want to come and use our charity? Do you want us to give you some help? One of the biggest things that they come back is, I don't think I'm bad enough to get help yet. And that's kind of, it really frustrates me. But that's sort of the mindset most people had, that like, I'm not bad enough to get it. It's like, well, where have you got to get to a certain level? Have you got to be so bad to try and get some help and seek some help? And a lot of the charities out there, they do have a medical evaluation to see what level you're at, and they take the most severe. And that's kind of where we came in at a charity. And we was like, why do people have to be so bad to get help in the first place?
You have to be in crisis before you get access to the support that you need.
It's so true. And then, you know, most people, especially for the first time speaking to a charity or an organisation, they won't express how bad they actually are. They'll probably dumb it down a bit. And then they'll go, oh, yeah, you're not quite there. You know, maybe later on, when if it gets worse, come back to us. And they probably are already there. So that's where we came in as a charity. And we take in anybody. We say it doesn't matter what your mindset is. You could be in the best place in life, or you could be having some serious issues. We'll take everyone. And hopefully that way it takes away the stigma of people having to say, I want to go and get help, because we help everyone. And also we capture people at all different levels. You know, being proactive is just as important as being reactive.
Isn't that bonkers though, that, you know, it'd be like saying to somebody, we're not interested in helping you until after you've had a heart attack, or don't come and speak to us until you're in full-blown diabetes, or, you know. And I just think that it's such an old-fashioned way of looking at how people should access support and help. And actually, you know, from some of the people that I've known, they're only likely to reach out for help when they're in a good space. Because once they're in that really dark place, that's when they start to withdraw and don't interact and ask for help.
I've just been a very good friend. I had to take myself away for 3 days because he was about to take his life. So I put everything aside and went and stayed with him for 3 days. And we went away somewhere, and hopefully, thankfully, now he's getting help. And I've been trying to talk to him the last 2 months, trying to get him some help. He said, oh, I was feeling bad when I spoke to you, but then afterwards for a few days, I was very good. So I was like, oh, I don't need to no more. But then he got bad again. And then he was, you know, he said, I was too bad to get help because I didn't want to talk to anyone. But then he felt good again. So he was like, oh, it's over now. And it's that horrible roller coaster up and down. And it's very difficult to people to know when to reach out and when to do something. But Karina, I'm really interested. The people that come to you, are they often at quite a crisis kind of state? Or do you get people who are going, I can feel something bad reoccurring? Or?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm going to answer that. I just wanted to touch on something that you mentioned before. there's also the side of the coin where the support won't go to someone that has severe trauma, because they're saying, it might be psychotherapists or not psychiatry, but psychotherapy kind of realms, they're saying because the trauma is too complex. So it's like, okay, how can you say no because the trauma is too complex? If someone's got CPTSD, it means they have complex trauma. They have PTSD, there could be a chance it is relating to something from the past as well. It might not just be the one thing, but they think it's the one thing. And people are being turned away. It's some of those individuals that come to me. And are they in crisis? I'd say 95% of the time they're in really bad crisis when they come to me. And they've waited so long, but they've reached out before, probably where they're not feeling so bad, but they've said, yes, I want to do this. Like, what's really going to happen? How are you going to change my life? And it's like, I have to obviously bring it back to reality. Okay, this is what I can do. This is what you can do, because it's I'm just navigating. If it's an individual that's purely life coaching and not really trauma focused, but it tends to be there's trauma involved in some way, then yeah, they're not in crisis. But the bulk of individuals that come is from a recommendation where it's like, actually, can you help my sister? My brother's in a lot of distress. I want to pass your number on to this person and so forth. That's kind of how it's working at the moment. And I'm absolutely okay with that, because I know I'm helping people that there is a potential risk of them not being here. So I would rather have that influence. And I know it's only over a certain level of time, journey. And I'll do the screening as well to see if they do need to have, you know, go through the medical doctor and so forth. A lot of the people, again, I'd say about 95% of the individuals that come to me have had therapy before. Ages ago. Yeah. And it's like, okay, so are you using any of those you know, techniques that you were showing? They're like, no, I just spoke. I'm like, okay. So you had trauma therapy and you were only speaking. And they're like, yeah, okay. Did they introduce this to you or this to you? And the answer is no. And I'm thinking, why are these basic techniques not being shown? And that's not me criticizing a therapist, the therapy world in any way, because I'm not a therapist, but there should be some basic techniques that are in place that people can transition their mind to a different space quite quickly, so they don't fall into that hole, because it feels like you fall into a hole, right? And it's just like everything goes dark and no one's around, and it's actually, life is still going on around you, but it doesn't feel like that. So yeah, it's predominantly people that are in really, like, they can barely talk, crying, they're saying that, you know, their addiction, excessive behaviors increase, and it's really awful. And by the time we get to like week 5, it's a very different story. But then I make sure that I touch base with absolutely everyone. I touch back in. It doesn't matter if they started 2 years ago. I make sure at least once a year I touch in, see how they're doing. Not asking for return business in any way. It's literally, I just want to see how you're doing. And they really appreciate that. So for you not to get a call or a letter or anything, you know, after all that service, it's like, for me, that's like, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense how someone so valuable, that's influenced so many people and in their own right has done all of this stuff, you wouldn't check in on them. Like, why not, you know?
And the military used to have a phrase, I don't know if they still use it, once they decided to terminate your service, and they just say service is no longer required.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, you're right. It's just very difficult, isn't it? And in the armed forces, you live through like 6 key morals or key phrases in life, of like integrity and discipline and loyalty. Loyalty is a big one. And you give it that loyalty completely. You know, you give it so much that you are willing to die on a battlefield for them. But then, you know, then once they go, okay, actually, yeah, you're not the person we want anymore. And it's like, see you later. And like literally see you, cut you off. You know, don't come back no more.
Almost like you're too much like hard work now. We're going to get rid of you.
Yeah. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to comprehend. It takes people a long time to get their heads around it, if they ever do. But yeah, I mean, like I say, there's a lot of ups, there's a lot of pros, a lot of cons. Yeah, it's a difficult concept.
And there's a lot of talk now about, you know, looking at mental health in a much more holistic way and understanding the impact that physical health has on mental health, diet, nutrition, sleep. Interesting, in the news this week, there's been a lot of talk around sleep and the impact that poor sleep patterns are having on people and on their longer term health as well. And I know something you're really interested in, Paul, and the work that you're wanting to do, the retreat you're wanting to set up, is going to focus not just on therapy, but on all of these areas as well.
Yeah, so one of the key things is we really want to hit at the heart of things. It's medication, you know. Personally, I'm not a big fan of medication, but I understand why the medication's there and why certain individuals need to take it. And I'm all for therapy as well, talking therapy and other stuff. And it really does help people. But people also really need to get to the core, and that's themselves, stuff that they do on a daily basis. Because there's organisations and charities, for example, that take people up a mountain climbing Kilimanjaro, and they take them out, and it's fantastic, it's great. But then they come back and they're back into their life again. But if we can implement the good daily habits, something that they can take on for the rest of their life, you know, that's really getting to the core of someone, really giving them purpose and self-worth on a daily, weekly, yearly basis. That for me is that, for me, that's the starting block. It's like when people go to a doctor, and the doctor, no matter what it is, whether it be an injury or whether it be a mental health reason, the doctor will give them tablets or medication and go, right, here you go, come back and see me in 6 weeks. And it's like, well, that's no good, is it? This is like, do that alongside something, do that alongside some sort of daily habits. It's not difficult for them to have like a booklet or a program or direct them to an app where they can use it. It should never just be one masking thing. It should be something that then the person can get to the core of them.
And is there a tendency to be over reliant on medication, do you think?
I was given medication initially. The first thing they said, I went to the doctors after lots of persuasion, went there, and he said, here's antidepressants for 6 weeks, come back in 6 weeks. And I remember took them for 2 weeks, really didn't work for me. I didn't feel good. I didn't like it. And also, but I was also, you know, clever enough to go, what is this going to do for me for 6 weeks? So, like, what's happening inside me is so deep. This medicate, like 6 weeks, I'm asking for help. For me, it was just take that and get out of my office sort of thing. But I do know people that do rely on it. And I was working with someone up until recently, and he actually wasn't in the military. He was just a friend of a friend. So I was working personally with him, and he'd been on medication, antidepressants, since he was 12 years old.
Wow.
And he's 26 now. And he's on the highest dose you could possibly take. And they probably don't do much for him, but he just has to take them. He's addicted to them. And after 12 weeks of working with him, he's now fully off them. And he's been off them for 18 months now. So, and it's fantastic. And he was just like, why hasn't anyone ever done that for me since I was a child or in a teenager? I'm not a doctor. I don't have any qualifications. So, you know, I'm not in a psychiatrist or anything. But, you know, it's just someone that cares and has a bit more understanding of spending a bit of time with someone and teaching them different ways and how they can take control of their life.
And Karina, I know you're sort of saying about the therapy side of things that you do, but it also sounds like you do focus on that whole life element as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I work outside of my business. I work in two other places. One's addiction recovery as an educator, and the other one's for a domestic violence and abuse charity based in my local area. So I do get to see the overview of what's happening in the local area statistically, the problems, the up-and-coming emerging trends that are happening as well, and just kind of like the restriction on funding for stuff, you know? So there's kind of, I'll answer your question in a moment, but there's, with the prescription drugs, over-the-counter drugs, there's a huge problem in our local area, huge problem with it. And even clients that I have, a lot of the time they come in, they start in crisis, and the amount of pain relief drugs that they're taking for an injury that was years and years ago that they know isn't causing any pain, but they're having mental pain and they're wanting to just let the pain stop, which is a very normal response when you have CPTSD. You want the pain to stop. And then there's these excessive behaviors or behaviors that you fall into or unhealthy habits, because they make you momentarily feel better. So the work that I do in general as a whole, yes, I focus specifically on getting to the root cause of the problem in regards to what's affected their nervous system and what impact that's had on the rest of their body. If they are taking any drugs, as we know, the drugs, if it's an opiate, will hit the head and the bowel and the respiratory system. So I know some of the other issues that they're having will be because of what they're choosing to take or they're feeling that they have to take for whatever reason. And I wouldn't have known that background without the experience I have with these other workplaces, to be honest with you, because it's a bit more, it's quite in depth from a medical perspective. But bringing in the healthy habits are so vital, but they have to be habits that work with the individual, with their culture, and with their lifestyle. Cost of living in this local area, it's pretty bad. Yeah, it's pretty bad. And so I know that they may not be able to have 5 fruit and veg. They may not be able to, even if they go to food banks. That's the reality of it. Not necessarily clients that I work with that are overseas, but within the UK. So it's a matter of repositioning it, see where they can get the resources, letting them understand that we can action plan. I call it a fire exit plan, which is something that's used in other workplaces as well, that when you do see yourself falling into crisis, this is what you can do. This is your little kind of get out of jail free card kind of thing, where it allows you not to fall back into the state that you were in and you're able to progress forward. So the holistic side is extremely important. When I work with trauma specifically, which might be slightly different from your angle, Paul, the way you explained how you want to do things and like the way you see things. For myself, I understand trauma in the sense of get to the root cause. It could be something that's feeding into a memory or flashback. You mentioned paranoia that you experienced, and I'm able to desensitize that. And if you don't have that anymore, then you don't need to fill the gap with anything. So you have space to go for a walk. I live in Brighton, so to go to the seafront, to see your friends. You also have a choice to have them to come round rather than you going to a pub. You have a choice to be out of the environments that you know can cause you harm in some way. But also, it's important that they have fun, including exercise, because that changes the hormones. It increases different chemicals. And we know, when you understand the science and neuroscience, just the way that, and physiology of the body, the brain, you know what things the individuals will need. I know in a session how to change someone's mood quite quickly, just so that they're able to feel regulated enough to continue with the session. And I understand the techniques, but I can show them and teach them that. And also let them kind of not have that overwhelm when they go to the shopping supermarket, for example. They see all this food and they want to get stuff and they can't because they've only got a fiver, for example. And it's like, it's okay. That fiver is very valuable. So you can utilize it in a different way, because everyone else's life doesn't matter. Your life matters right now, you know? So having that holistic view, but keeping it very real to culture and where they stand in life in that present moment is really important.
Amazing. And the environment there you're talking about there, Karina, but that's certainly a challenge in the military world, because actually, you know, the thing that has caused you the trauma is the same environment in which you live and breathe and socialise and work and everything else.
Yeah. So the and Paul will be able to speak to that as well, to speak to that specifically. But, you know, our basic level need is environment. And I don't have that type of background, but I know for myself, if my environment's unstable, I can't progress with someone that as a survivor. I call myself a hero, not survivor, but with that type of background, it's like, for me, my environment has to be stable. If I know I've got to move home, everything goes upside down in my head, and it just feels like I'm not safe, everything's going wrong, and my life could be amazing, and if I know I've got to move home for whatever reason, because it happens, it's like everything goes out the window and it just feels like I'm that little child again. So the environment's really important. If we then move into the military world, I guess, Paul, you could speak to that.
Yeah, I think in the military world, and Mike, you know this very well, it's come away from it in a bit now, but it used to be a huge drinking culture. And I mean huge. And everything was like fast. So I remember turning up at 17 years old, and straight away my squadron, maybe like 30 guys, were like, and this is on a Tuesday, we're like down the pub, 6 o'clock, be there. And then everyone would get so drunk until they passed out, do really silly things, get in at 3 o'clock in the morning, have maybe 2 hours kip up, and then go for a 10 mile fast run, then in at work, back down the pub again at 6 o'clock. And this just went on every single day. And when you're young and you're with people, you can kind of get away with it. But then you leave it. But also in the armed forces, there's quite a passive aggressive, well, not even passive, it's quite an aggressive way of talking to each other, which you don't necessarily have in the normal world. Like, if something went wrong, you would shout and scream at the person. You might even, like, you know, square up to each other. Then after 2 minutes of that being resolved, you're shaking hands, arm around each other, and you get on. Where you can't go into a corporate world and do that with each other. So given that heavy drinking culture, that very fast, you know, everything or nothing's way of being, and also that somewhat of aggressive sort of get it all out, just get it off your chest and get it overdone with. You can't bring that into the normal world. And a lot of people have to adjust themselves into the normal world. And it's very difficult because not only do they feel alone, they feel like they're completely different to everyone else. They're, you know, feel alienated, if you like. And I often find that people leaving the armed forces, there's like a 2 year, I call it like a 2 year whirlwind. For that 2 years, they're completely all over the place. Like, they're just trying to find themselves. Quite often they isolate, they grow big beards because you're not allowed to grow a beard. You have to shave every day in the armed forces.
Now that makes sense.
You do, and in that 2 year period, you often find they probably go through about 14 different jobs. Often go through divorce, split away, want to go traveling and be on their own, try and find themselves. Mm. Often go into do a lot of drugs, drink a lot of alcohol. Mm. And you can see, I see it when people come out, and I want to go and hold their hands so bad and say, look, but I also know it's a process that they've got to go through. And it's okay to give them a good, you know, nudge every now and then and go, have you thought about doing this? And yeah. I often find leading by example is the best way to approach people sometimes. Just let them see, just like I've talked about, I just say to people, I've just been doing some cold water therapy this last week. I feel so good of it. So rather than say to someone, I think you should try this, I just say, my friends have been doing it. And
it's being a bit suggestive, basically, in a nice subtle way.
My wife and her friends have taken up cold water swimming. They keep saying to me, why don't you come along and try it? No, thank you very much. No.
I can't think of anything worse, but I know how beneficial it is at the same time. But I get cold and I can't get warm. So I'm just like, nah, just not my thing.
I'm the same. And so a lot of the teachings that we teach people, cold water therapy is one of them, and the whole plethora of different things. But what we do is we say to people, we don't go, come and try this cold water therapy, or come and stand in cold water for 2 minutes. You're going to feel good. What we do, first of all, is we explain what happens biologically, psychologically, everything to, you know, the different chemicals in your body. We explain about the benefits for immune system and for cancer. And we talk about the nervous system and how it ignites certain parts of our brain and hormones that we don't normally ignite. And when people go, oh my God, that's incredible. Like, and it only takes 2 minutes of being discomfortable. I'm like, yeah, that's all it is. Or 30 seconds. And then we go and do it. And then people have a much more pull and understanding to want to go and do it. And most of the stuff that we teach people, you know, like gratitude can be done in 10 seconds. Affirmations can be done in 20 seconds. So we do show all these amazing things that they can benefit hugely from. And most of it can be done in 10, 15, 20 minutes. And then you can find that time sporadically throughout the day to do these different things. But it's just getting people to buy into it and to actually, not just because when they're with us, they're like, amazing, it's amazing. I could do this forever. But we all know once you walk away and you're out that door and you roll into your daily habits and your new life and you're in a different environment, like we were talking about earlier, it's very easy to fall back into your old habits and not go do what you know you should be. That makes you feel better.
Well, I think the key word in all of that was habits, isn't it? It's habits, and old habits are hard to break and new habits are hard to form. Sorry, Karina, go on.
No, it's good that you said that, because it's kind of relating to the habit side as well. The nervous system specifically, I think there's such a disconnect from us with our nervous system. And if in general, as a human race, we understand that actually if we are friends with our nervous system, we understand how it works and the impact it has on the rest of our life, we would treat our bodies and look after ourselves probably in a much better, safer way as well. And that sleep element as well comes into it. If you look at behavior and so forth, that element of sleep, it is important. You know, people that go drinking, or if we go drinking, we know that within 20 minutes it's going to hit the body, it's going to hit the brain, the respiratory system, the bowel. We know that's going to happen. And the only way to recover from that is actually sleep. There's all these things, hangover cure, hair of the dog, which is stupid because obviously you're putting more alcohol in and your body's trying to recover from it and you didn't have enough sleep. A lot of the time it's not enough sleep. So just understanding that and kind of shifting that into, in a way that you explain it, to individuals that come and work with you is amazing. But there's just not enough connection to self. It's kind of like, I need these things to help me, you know, before I can do that. It's just like the individual that you said was after 3 days they didn't really feel like they needed help, then they fell back into the cycle. There's that culture that we have where we tend to say, I can't do that until I've done that, or I'm not drunk enough to be able to do that. And if that language keeps continuing, their anti-social message, basically, their messages, I don't think social is the right word, but their messages that are pulling us back and not allowing us to move forward in our true expression of what we're needing to say, you know, it's like...
Yeah, it becomes totally counterproductive.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I wanted to pick up on some of this as well, because you mentioned, you know, the problems with people misusing over-the-counter medication. But, you know, there is, and Paul, you've mentioned the drink culture within the military. I think talking to some of my friends who have more recently left the military, I think that has become less of a culture with some of the younger generation. But what I was going to talk about here is the tendency for people who have got, who are struggling, who have got mental health issues, to self-medicate. And alcohol is often one of those areas that people self-medicate with. And as you said there, Karina, you know, when you're drinking, it's affecting all aspects of your physiology. And we all know if you've had a good skinful, you don't sleep. It's not restorative sleep.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I was going to say, like, you know, alcohol is a depressant. And I think if people understand that and understand that what that means, if they are struggling with mental health and they are leaning towards that. Now, I'm not talking about the crowd that has an addiction. I'm talking about the crowd before that doesn't see themselves as having an addiction, but they like that alcohol maybe on a daily thing, but not so excessively where they may not fall into the category when you look at the unit size. Yeah. But that particular audience, I feel, if they understand it's a depressant, so you depress means you're pushing things down, and then the next day you do the same. And you know you've got these things that you need to do, and you do it, it's in a logical way. It's like almost like I have to do that, and it's almost like a list. I go to work, come back, make dinner, I'll do that, I can have a drink, so it's fine. I've done everything that I need to do. But actually, you're not going to be working through or processing anything realistically because everything's been depressed down. Then if someone then does take drugs, in the sense of not the alcohol, the drug, but drugs, let's just say cocaine, then it's going to change that and it's not a depressant anymore. Do you see what I mean? So it's, I think people understand that actually this is what's happening. And when you combine the two, the polydrug use, the reason why you can't, this is from, you know, the other work that I do, the reason why you feel like your chest is going so tight and you feel like you can't breathe is because you've created this other chemical that you didn't intend to, that's now putting you in this state. And then what do? They tend to have something that depresses it back down to regulate. It's not regulating. You have to be consciously aware to regulate, right? So I think having those insights are so important, just in snippets everywhere, for people to understand that actually it's not really the best way to do it, because that's the behaviors that can then pull you into the addiction or excessive behaviors. Yeah.
And I think even for healthy people, you know, I speaking on behalf of myself, but also anecdotally on a number of my friends groups, certainly I think we all fell into the trap of that 5 o'clock gin and tonic throughout lockdown, because everything just became so routine, Groundhog Day-ish, and it kind of, you just get into that habit, and before you know it, you're having a couple of gin and tonics every night because you've built that habit without realizing it.
Yeah, it happens in the corporate world, but from the way you and Paul explained it, it's quite a norm, or was the norm for the military as well, to have the drinks. Like the corporate world, it's just, I just remember, and I feel my lifestyle now is so much healthier. Like I would take this lifestyle any day than the lifestyle that I had previously.
Well, your entire social life was...
Yeah, it was all about drinking. Everything was about going to the pub. And Brighton's kind of like that. It's got that social vibe and stuff. But then you get to a point where you have that, you kind of sit back and you look at everything, everyone that you're drinking with, you just think to yourself, I'm not doing what's right. Like you have that feeling, but a lot of people disregard it and just crack on anyway. But it's like when you have that little signal, which is your nervous system speaking to you, and it's, you know, it's that kind of reason inside, and it's just like, it's important that we listen to that. When we feel it, listen to it, hear it, and be like, okay, I'll go home now. And you just say bye, regardless of anyone saying have another or have another. If you realise it's something that's happening over and over, you just think, no, it's time for me to go, because I'm going to put me first, and I'm important, and I love me, all of that stuff, which is kind of life coachy stuff, but also allows you to feel good about yourself again. I've had a good time. I don't need to make my good time better. It's enough. I can go home.
Yeah. And certainly, you know, Paul, I'm sure, will agree with me here, but in the military, your entire social life was built around the naffy bar, the mess, the sergeant's mess, the warrant officer's mess, the officer's mess, you know, and it was everything. You know, the only place you had as an ordinary rank, well, where you could socialise with other people and meet people for any sort of social event was in the bar. That was your primary point. And I see it now, you know, in the corporate world, we go to networking, drinks. We go to conference and drink, you know, so it's endemic across all sorts of career paths, I think.
And I think, Karina, like you said, it's knowing to just have a few. No, so my girlfriend is incredible. Like she'll have a few drinks throughout the evening. She's the life and soul, like genuinely the life and soul. And she'll get to like 11 o'clock and be like, yeah, I'm done. But me, I'm just like, oh, I can't go now. I can't leave everyone. And, you know, I said, look at all this drink that's still here to be drunk. And then I'll come in at like 4 o'clock in the morning and just be, I feel awful the next day. And she's up for an early morning jog or swim in the sea or whatever it is. And I'm just like, and then I say every time, I sit, I'm going home with you next time. Then I don't, because I'm in that moment. I mean, so we all have a different way of, like, you know, that outlook on life and how we should be socially, you know, behaving. And so it's very difficult. Like, I haven't been able to get out of that sort of rut. But also, I'm enjoying myself at the same time. So yeah. It's difficult. You know, I don't like it the day after, but during that moment in time, I'm having so much fun that I don't want to leave that moment.
And of course, in the military, we're also competitive, aren't we? So nobody wants to be the first man or woman to go. And you can't be seen to be a lightweight and not be keeping up with everybody else. And you know, last man standing is seen as being kudos. You know, there's...
Well, I remember when I joined, I was like 17 years old, and we have 8-man rooms. So there'd be 8 of us in the room, and we'd all go up. And if someone dare go back early, then they're going to get absolutely terrorized by the other 7 when they come in drunk. So you have to stay up. Like, you could not go back early. And I think I stayed in that 8-man room for maybe 5 years. So for 5 years, I had to go out till 3 o'clock in the morning with everyone, or I don't even want to say over here what would happen to me or the person that went over. Exactly. So
you find yourself getting bed posted in the middle of the night.
Oh, all sorts of bad things have happened. Yeah. You'd have stuff all over you. Someone probably weed on you also. So yeah, it's not worth it.
Peer pressure is an awful thing, isn't it?
I was going to say, if you think of that though, so you're in that type of field the work where you're working in military, and then you're not really having time to think because you're drinking, which is depressing everything. You wake up, you've got to go straight into the routines. I'm just going off what people have told me, what I see in the movies, guys. So if I'm well off, just let me know. And you go straight into the routine, and then probably the next, you know, depending how the day goes, again, it's a drinking. So it's heightened emotions, adrenaline, and then to calm that down, which works because it's a depressant, alcohol's a depressant, so it brings it back down. So you feel like you're okay. So when you then come out, if you think when you come out of all that responsibility and that camaraderie and you're not getting any support anymore and so forth, there's this kind of void, massive void, because it's like, what the hell do I do now? And there's people, individuals that are ex-military that I work with, have worked with, no one at the moment, and they come to me, it's like, I don't know what to do with my life. It's like, my lifestyle's different. I don't know how to communicate to my girlfriend anymore. It's just like, what's wrong with me? And it's like, there is nothing wrong with you. It's an adjustment period, you know, and that's what we can work on. So things don't feel so heightened. Because as soon as it feels heightened, normally they'd have a drink and it pushes it back down. So it makes sense. It completely makes sense how that depression could then turn into something even more sinister, you know, where it just starts going, getting worse and worse and worse.
It's so true. And I think it's important to say that, you know, in the military, things have changed a lot. I think the generations coming up, they're not as interested in drinking. And, you know, but then on the flip side, they seem to be a lot more isolated. So they'll be in their rooms, play computer games or watching movies on their own rather than having that social circle. So there's a bit of a, you know, a pro and con on that side.
Well, that brings us to the end of part one of this absolutely fascinating podcast. Our guests, I'm sure you'll agree, have been absolutely fantastic so far. Lots more to discuss in part two. So keep an eye out for that, which we'll be releasing as a follow-up. This has been the Advent IM podcast, Risk and Business.